Today's episode is sponsored by Morgan Stanley. Recent efforts to test blockchain's viability as a settlement and payment alternative are the first critical step towards adopting the technology. Yet many questions remain about mainstream implementation. Read more at morganstanley.com/blockchain. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, member SIPC.
Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. Sometimes lately, it seems like the stock market is living on a different planet than the rest of us. It's shrugged off rumblings of tariff spats, inflation fears, and many a Trump tweet storm. Last week, the U.S. fired the first shot in an all-out trade war with China. And still, U.S. stock indices continue to climb. In fact, we're in the second longest bull market run since World War II. Maybe your 401k already told you that. Here to talk with me about whether the markets are being irrational, or I am, is Richard Bernstein. He's the chief executive officer of Richard Bernstein Advisors in New York and a long-time stock market strategist on Wall Street, including many years at Merrill Lynch. Rich, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for inviting me on the podcast.
All right. So the usual caveat, we're recording this Tuesday morning before markets open. So who knows what could happen between now and when this airs on Wednesday. But we certainly know that markets have done well since the trade war kicked into full gear on Friday. And I want to get into some definitional terms with you. What's a bull market? What's a bear market? Not everybody listening to this podcast has spent years kind of hanging around markets like we have. But got to start with the biggest question that is on my mind, which is, why does Wall Street at this point not care that we're in a trade war with China?
You know, Ben, I wouldn't say that Wall Street doesn't care. I think that's a bit strong. I would say that the trade wars right now for where they are taking a back seat to the fundamentals in the U.S. economy. I mean, the U.S. economy is really hitting on all eight cylinders right now. And I think that's the more important story for the stock market. You know, not that trade and trade wars aren't important, but I think the fundamentals are ultimately what are going to drive the market. And so I think right now it's a little bit, trade is taking a little bit of a back seat. Now, of course, if we start exacerbating the situation in trade, it could move to the front seat pretty quickly. But I think for the time being, it's taking a back seat.
And I wonder, this is sort of my pet theory about it, is that markets had kind of priced in the first round of significant tariffs with China, and that the implementation of them hasn't actually been worse than we feared. You haven't seen a lot of tweets from President Trump saying, you know, this is just the beginning and I've got $500 billion in total, I'm ready to go. There's not a lot of back and forth or yelling or anger in the initial phases of this. And, you know, based on my reporting, that's not an accident that the White House has put together a strategy where they're not going to go out and rattle the sabers a whole lot. They're going to let perhaps some talks behind the scenes go forward and maybe get a resolution. Do you think some of the positive reaction in markets, obviously it's to do with good economic numbers and the macro economy and all the rest of it, but at least on trade, expected this first round and there hasn't been a whole lot of excess noise around it?
Yeah, the noise I think is very important, but I would almost twist it around. And I think the noise has somewhat subsided because the market took the initial noise quite badly. You know, one could agree with the policy or not. I don't think that's the issue right now. I think if there's a rational approach, I think the markets can digest that for at least some period of time. But if it's real scattershot emotional, I think the stock market has a lot of trouble with that.
Yeah. And I mean, let's talk about the potential impact on the economy of this trade fight with China. We're at relatively small numbers now, $34 billion on each side. There's threats of that ratcheting up to $200 billion in the next round of these things. Still small numbers in terms of the overall macro U.S. economy, but certainly the fear is that, you know, there'll be a significant impact to U.S. exporters, particularly farmers who want to sell products into China, and then ultimately an impact on U.S. consumers. If we get into the bigger numbers, you're talking about stuff that everyday folks buy from China that makes products more expensive. So there is the potential for spillover effects into the broader economy if this gets worse, right? And markets presumably wouldn't really like that.
Yeah, there is no doubt that the spillover effects can be quite big and can last quite a long time. You know, we economists like to talk about multiplier effects, where one thing happens and that leads to another, to another, to another. And usually they talk about multipliers in a very positive framework. Fiscal stimulus or monetary stimulus has very high multipliers, which cause the economy to expand. I think what people perhaps aren't talking enough about are the negative multipliers that can go along with really out-of-control trade wars. And you've already seen small examples of it. You know, companies have that import steel and import aluminum and then maybe export product to Europe have talked about moving production to Europe because they get caught on the import tariffs of steel and aluminum, and then they get caught on the export tariffs importing to, or the import tariffs, I should say, in Europe, importing product into Europe. So why not avoid it and just build the thing in Europe? You know, things like that. Yes, there can be many negative multiplier effects upon that. Ben, I would say the bigger issue, though, which I don't think people are paying enough attention to, is that this is one of many policies right now that are very pro-inflation. You know, if you think about what tariffs are supposed to do, they're supposed to restrict the flow of goods and services. And I don't think there has been any time in history where restricting the flow of goods and services has not been inflationary. I mean, that just defies logic. I don't think people have thought about just that basic point enough and what it means for consumers and what it means for consumption.
Yeah, that's a good point to raise inflation generally, because I did want to get into that as sort of risks to the bull market that we're in. And, you know, I'd pitched to my editor a story recently, like, we really need to write about inflation creeping up and the impact on the economy and the Fed and perhaps President Trump and his reelection. And then we got the jobs number on Friday, and wages did not seem to be rising very quickly. And you don't see a lot of inflationary pressure in wages, but you do see it in consumer prices and producer prices and, you know, nudging up to and above the Fed's 2% target. So, you know, there's inflation out there. And now you add this inflationary aspect of trade policy and tariffs. So should the markets be more worried about inflation in general, and then the Fed having to raise interest rates more quickly and slow down the economy?
Right. Well, I think, you know, the beauty of this cycle has been that it's been tremendously elongated. You know, a lot of people said that it hasn't been a normal cycle. It's actually been quite normal. It's just been greatly elongated. And that's largely because we're coming out of a credit bubble and there was no credit to juice up the early stages of the expansion. But it's been a very normal cycle, just in tremendously elongated. And what that's meant is that at every stage of the economic cycle, normal things have happened. They just happened more slowly than people would have normally expected. And I think with the increase in inflation, that's exactly what's going on. Inflation expectations actually troughed 2 years ago. It was June of 2016 that inflation expectations troughed. Now, most people would say, well, big deal. You know, nothing's really happened. But that's completely untrue. In the backdrop, stocks and commodities have dramatically outperformed fixed income and bonds and income-oriented investments because inflation is the kryptonite of income. But yet, most people perceive that nothing's actually happened in the markets. And my argument is the market is paying a huge amount of attention to this increase in inflation, even though we don't have very high rates on an absolute basis. But it's happening so slowly that nobody knows it's even happening. It's like watching paint dry.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, watching inflation and all this stuff generally is like watching paint dry, but that's a subject for another time. We'll be right back with more from Rich Bernstein, but first, a word from our sponsor.
A message from Morgan Stanley. Attracted by the potential for lower processing costs and stronger security for a range of transactions, financial players are testing blockchain's viability as a settlement and payment alternative. But, meanwhile, many questions remain about the mainstream implementation and the challenges ahead. Development and deployment costs could be high, potentially more than simpler alternatives like updating legacy infrastructure. In addition, computing, bandwidth, and storage requirements may grow exponentially, and will need to be seamlessly integrated between blockchain protocols and legacy systems. Read more at morganstanley.com/blockchain. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, member SIPC.
The Trump administration imposed tariffs on $34 billion worth of Chinese goods. China immediately retaliated.
There have been 9 own goals in the World Cup so far this summer. That's the highest in tournament history. This is the 10th own goal of the summer. Even if the U.S. didn't enter the tournament, we
still... Let's take a quick pause and do a little Markets 101 for those listeners who, you know, don't spend a lot of time on this or hear kind of buzzwords about bull markets and bear markets and maybe act like they know what they are, but don't really. And we talk a lot about this being the longest bull market since World War II. So just define for the listener, what is a bull market?
Right. A bull market. I mean, it's much easier to find a bull market than a bear market. A bull market is a period in time where stocks rise, I would argue, more than the normal rate of return on stocks. So through time, stocks tend to return about 8 to 10% per year over long periods of time. So I would argue a bull market is when you get an extended period of time where the return on stocks is above 8 to 10%. Now, this period has been such a period where the market troughed in March of 2009 and has been appreciating since that point at a much higher rate than that 8 to 10% per year. Now, that doesn't mean that every year has to be an extraordinary year, but, you know, through time, there'll be good years and bad years, you'll get way more than that sort of normal 8 to 10% per year. Some will be tremendous years, you know, maybe up 30% or something, and some will be kind of mediocre, maybe up 5, 6, 7, but you're not going to have an extended period where returns are negative. That's how I would define a bull market.
Gotcha. And you mentioned that it's easier to define than a bear market. And of course, that's true. There's sort of a theory that, you know, you're in a bear market, you know, when you see it and when you know it and when you feel it. But I mean, there are some definitions of it, you know, a period of, 10% correction from the most recent high that lasts for a certain period of time. Anyway, what is your definition of a bear market?
Yeah, I would say, you know, again, bear markets are kind of up, you know, in the eye of the beholder, so to speak. But, you know, most people would say if the market goes down 10%, that would be called a correction, meaning kind of a short-term dip in the markets. Generally, if markets go down 20% or more from their highs, people define it as a bear market. I'm not sure I would agree with that definition. Certainly down 20% is very painful. I'm not belittling that at all. But it seems to me that a real bear market should occur over quarters, not over weeks. And, you know, I think in what happens now, especially with the media attention to the stock market, if the market goes down any amount, all of a sudden all you're hearing about is a potential bear market over and over again. I think that's very unfair. I think if you have an extended period where returns are negative, you do cross that negative 20%, but it goes on for an extended period of time. I think that's what I would describe as a bear market. I had a professor in business school who once said that the true bear markets are like water torture. They just drip, 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 and a little bit negative, a little bit negative, a little bit negative, and they just drive you insane. And I think that's actually a pretty good emotional definition of a bear market.
Yeah, whereas a correction is more of like a sharp punch to the face.
Correct.
Or something that you can kind of deal with and then move on. And you can theoretically have bear markets within longer-term bull markets, or you can obviously certainly have corrections within a longer-term bull market, and arguably we've seen a few of those over this long, extended bull market that we're in right now. I got to say, I'm reminded of the Seinfeld episode where Elaine tells Jerry that she's dating somebody in high finance, and his definition of that is bulls, bears, people from Connecticut, which is always a favorite definition to me of who's involved in Wall
right.
Street.
Point of information, I do not live in Connecticut.
Ah, there you go. Okay, so he's not one of those, but he does know about bulls and bears. Yeah. You know, all right, well, let's talk about tax cuts for a second, and I have two kind of threads I want to pull on that, and I'll just start with the first one, which is, do you view the kind of beneficial impact for the stock market as basically played out, that its impact on earnings is well known, and its impact on GDP growth is now pretty well known. And we've gotten the bang for the buck we're going to get in stocks from the tax cuts.
I would say the answer to that is still, I don't think people actually know. And the reason I say that is that I'm a firm believer that tax cuts have a leakage effect. And what I mean by leakage is you don't know how much of the benefits stay in the domestic economy and how much leak abroad. And again, getting back to the word I used before, you don't know the multiplier effects of what goes on. So what do I mean by leakage? I mean, look, if people got a personal tax cut, if they decide to save it and they invest in an emerging market equity fund, the tax cut has just gone to lower the cost of capital in the emerging markets and will benefit the emerging market economies potentially more than the U.S. economy. If somebody goes and buys, decides they want to spend their personal tax cut and wants to buy a TV, well, we all know no TVs are made in the United States. So what's just happened is the tax cut has gone to benefit China or Taiwan or Korea or Mexico or wherever that TV is made. So a tax cut with a large trade deficit is always going to have some element of leakage. I don't think economists have studied that enough, and I'm not saying I know the effect. I just don't think people know the effect well enough to make a definitive statement as to how much is going to stay here and what the multiplier effects will be and how much is leaked abroad and will benefit non-U.S. Countries, non-U.S. economies, rather. I don't think people know. I think if you look at analyst profit forecasts that have come after the tax cut was put in place, they skyrocketed. Analysts raised estimates at a record pace after the tax cut. One of the reasons why the stock market was up, by the way. They've now calmed down. They're still raising estimates, but not nearly at the pace they were to adjust for the tax cut. So there was clearly a short-term effect. The long-term effects you mentioned, Ben, I'm not quite sure if one can measure them or not.
Gotcha. All right. So the second thread I wanted to pull is, you know, we're getting this tasty dessert of lower corporate tax rates and benefits to the owners of capital and shareholders, and all that is bullish for stocks. You know, the bill for this may come due in a number of years, maybe not in the far distant future, where you've got significantly higher short-term deficits and a larger national debt, a larger deficit as the share of GDP. And, you know, let's put aside the Kudlow argument and others that this is going to juice growth so much that it'll actually reduce deficits. I don't know a lot of people who actually agree with that and think that that's actually going to happen. The result is likely to be higher debt, higher deficit. Doesn't that longer term mean higher interest rates, slower economic growth, and, you know, negative outcomes for the stock market?
You know, what's interesting about that is Ben, that people have been talking about, you know, the kind of lead weight on growth for some time, and it's actually happened. And now people can't understand why it's happened. And are, you know, in other words, if you look at the secular growth rate of the U.S. economy, it's clearly slowed. And I would suggest that one of the reasons why is that past administrations, both Democratic and Republican, have you know, used debt for the two-year election cycle. And what they've done is they've used debt, which is a long-term liability, to juice up short-term consumption for the two-year election cycle, right? I mean, politicians love you know, happy people. You know, Herbert Hoover, you know, chicken in every pot, car in every garage. You know, that's the normal thing. But and so this is not a partisan statement by any means, but it's been going on for a long time. And the secular growth rate of the U.S. economy is already suffering as a result of that. You know, what you're doing is you're taking a very short-term asset, meaning consumption, and financing it with a long-term liability, 10 or 20 or 30-year debt. And what that does is the interest payments can't be used for domestic spending or domestic investment. So essentially, you weigh down the long-term growth rate of the economy. It's already happening. I think that's one of the funniest things that's going on, is that we're all saying how the U.S. economy has got to grow at a faster rate. What did we do? We just did exactly what every other political administration has done, is we used debt to short-term juice up the economy, and we're going to weigh down the long-term growth rate when it's already there. I mean, it's kind of funny that we can't even recognize it.
Right, when we're in it, when we're at a 2 to 3% economy that maybe otherwise could be a 3 to 4% or 5% growth economy. Yeah, absolutely agree with that. All right, so let's talk about the U.S. economy and the stock market, kind of put them together and think of them as an automobile that is running really well right now, kind of cruising along, looking good. Let's pop up the hood, look underneath it. What are you looking for in terms of, you know, signals that you will see that suggest that, you know, there are problems, that things are slowing down both for the economy and the markets? What are the signals that the car is going off the tracks a little bit?
Okay. So there's kind of three categories that we look at my firm. First would be corporate profits, because remember, we're investors. I'm not a formal economist. So corporate profits more so than the overall economy. Number two is liquidity, and I'll define that for you in a second. And number three would be kind of sentiment and valuation for the stock market. Corporate profits right now are very strong in the United States. They're not necessarily strong around the world. If you look in Europe and Japan, corporate profits are under some considerable pressure. But in the United States, corporate profits are very, very healthy right now. I don't think we really have to worry about that one. Number two, liquidity. The best way for individuals to look at liquidity is to look at the yield curve. And there's been a lot of attention paid to the yield curve. You know, the difference between, say, the yield on two-year notes and the yield on 10-year notes, that spread is very narrow. People are very worried about that. All I will say is that our research shows that a narrow spread is not bearish. A narrow spread is actually quite bullish for stocks. But when short-term rates go above long-term rates, in Wall Street parlance, the curve becomes inverted, that's a very bad sign. It gives you usually about 6 to 12 months to reposition your portfolio and become more defensive. But I'm enjoying right now, everybody's watching the yield curve tick by tick, trying to anticipate when's it going to go negative and when's the recession coming. I think that's a bit premature. And then sentiment and valuation, I'm sure most of your listeners are not extraordinarily bullish on stocks, right? I'm sure they're worried about either income, or they're worried about protecting their portfolio against the next bear market. They're worried to some extent about 2008 repeating. That's not usually what you'll see at the peak of a bull market or the peak of an economic cycle. So we're in a late cycle environment, but I want your listeners to differentiate between a late cycle environment and late in the cycle. Late in the cycle means, you know, the clock is ticking and the abyss is coming. A late cycle can go on for years.
Right. So we could be in late cycle for quite a while.
We could.
And people wouldn't have to really change anything. So that nicely kind of leads into my next question, which was just for the average investor who regularly kind of looks at their 401k and maybe they've got a little bit of money that they're not quite sure what to do with, put more into stocks, buy bonds, real estate, should they get into foreign markets? What is your message to that person who has maybe a little bit of money they want to put to work somewhere, but not quite certain that stocks are the right place to put it?
Right. So the key thing when I get this question, and of course I get this question quite a bit at parties and the such, is it depends on the person's age who's asking me the question. I think one of the things that younger people, 20-somethings, 30-somethings, don't take advantage of is time. If you're looking, if you've got a 401k, you've got an IRA, and you're a 20-something or 30-something, you should be investing for maximum risk. Because, you know, 65 is 30, 40 years away. I mean, that's an immense amount of time. You know, if the stock market goes down for 5 years, you still got 30 years to go. If you're 65, or you're roughly 60, which would put me in that category, that becomes a little more of a question of your risk tolerance. Of course, you want to calm down a little bit, but the thing you want to remember is that if you're 60, hopefully you've got 20 plus years to go. And you don't want to get too conservative too early. And I think what a lot of people do is they focus too much on income, and they give up the growth of that 20 or 30 year time frame. You know, just because you're retired doesn't mean that the story's over. I think one has to remember about, you know, hopefully life expectancy will be long, and you don't want to become too income oriented too quickly, because let's say the market goes down for 2 or 3 years, you'll still have 17 years to go. I mean, and people forget that. They get too scared. And I think, you know, you even mentioned this, Ben, at the beginning that you know, you said your 401k may be reflecting the bull market. But remember, in 2008, people panicked about their 401k. And I think people have to be very careful about trying to time movements in an IRA or a 401k.
All right, so let's say you're a 46-year-old journalist and podcast host who, I'm just kidding you. I'm going to ask you to design my specific portfolio on this podcast. That would not be at all a conflict of interest or something I shouldn't be doing, so I won't do that. But we'll just talk offline afterwards, and I'll take 3 hours of your time. All right, so you've got this bull market. It's basically, you know, raging through the streets of Wall Street. What is going to kill the bull?
I think there's a couple of things. One is we could have a trade war. I mean, trade war would really be, you know, as I said, such a disruption to the flow of goods and services that it would disrupt not only the U.S. economy but the global economy. We you know, I understand the point behind what the president's trying to do and restructure the U.S. economy is basically what he's trying to do. I get that. I understand it. You can't do that in a short period of time. We don't have the manufacturing capacity to do that in a short period of time. So disruptions to the flow, you know, of goods and services for a year or 2 years could be devastating to the U.S. economy. I think, you know, I hope that the president and his advisors understand that. And I think the stock market has told him that in no uncertain terms if you look at the performance in June, or the second half of June. I think that was the message. Outside of that, I think we have to go back to what I said before. If corporate profits roll over, if too much liquidity is withdrawn from the economy via the Federal Reserve, and people are out of their heads bullish, that's a real bad sign. I don't think we're there right now. So I think it's going to pay to stay, you know, at least reasonably bullish for the foreseeable future.
Gotcha. So the bull marches on. Rich Bernstein, thank you so much for joining Politico Money, and we hope to have you back.
Great. Thanks, Ben.
Live fast, die young, bull rider.
And that's all for Politico Money this week. Thanks so much to Rich Bernstein for joining me. Thanks to my producer, Ruth Morris. Our executive producer is Dave Shaw. If you're liking the show, please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Rate us and write a written review. And we'll be back with you next week.
You're just outside the buck and shoot. You lose the spur, you lose your seat, and you lose yourself. By now he's bucking mean and dirty, slinging mud, cowboy boots, and kicking clowns.